Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We're recording on Super Tuesday morning, Tuesday. If you're listening to my radio show every day, you will be hearing Alex Salmon from Slate.com talking about Emily's List. And his article at Slate.com was basically asking the question, why is Emily List appearing to be aiding and abetting Republicans who in the end turn out to be anti-choice? And I read his article and I wanted like to punch out a ceiling. Okay. I was like so upset. And in part, people need to know that I have a personal vendetta against Emily's List, but that's personal. This is not about me. This is about what Emily's List is doing. And then last night, I am watching MSNBC. This is Monday night. And who comes on but the new head of Emily's List? And I thought, oh, good. In light of what was just written at Slate.com, maybe it'll be like, you know, a little bit of a pushback. Instead, it was like the biggest puff piece I have ever seen. It was a free commercial for Emily's List. So let me share with you what I just posted on my Facebook page and how I want to begin the show, and then I will toss to my first guest. Here we go. This was on Facebook. You can go to both articles by going to my Facebook page or just by following these stories. The story of North Carolina and abortion is actually connected to the story of the sellout of Emily's List that is aiding the anti-choice GOP. Read this, I write on Facebook, and then go to the first link. So here's how I begin. Last night, MSNBC had the new head of Emily's List on the air, a puff interview that did not discuss any of the legitimate criticisms of the organization. Ironically, I interviewed the author of the Slate.com piece entitled, What's Happening to Emily's List? This election cycle, the group has waded into races in ways that threaten to help Republicans and hurt Democrats. We got to read this article by Alex Salmon. Then I wrote, if you read the article, make sure you get to the end, because this story is mind-blowing, because we all remember the story being revisited today on National Public Radio. And this is a story from National Public Radio talking about Super Tuesday. But then a Democratic State House representative from Charlotte, Tricia Gotham, switched parties and gave Republicans a decisive supermajority in the legislature that allowed a 12-week abortion ban with limited exceptions to pass, one the governor could not overturn with a veto. This is the story about Super Tuesday and North Carolina and how abortion is front and center in the elections that are happening in North Carolina on Super Tuesday. All right, so that's NPR. I'm watching MSNBC. I've just done an interview with Alex Salmon, but this is the nugget from his piece that makes me absolutely crazy. The group, in this case, Emily's List, infamously endorsed a Democrat, North Carolina State Representative Tricia Gotham. Remember, I just read about her in the NPR story. In 2022, only for her to switch party affiliations to the GOP upon winning her election. Then she became the final vote for a statewide abortion ban that passed thereafter. Now here is the cryptic sentence. Take this down, put it on your refrigerator door. That episode in particular raised serious questions about Emily's List vetting process, given that the North Carolina State Rep Gotham is the cousin of Emily Kane, who was then the executive director of Emily's List. Anyway, just to let you know, now you know why when I was watching MSNBC last night, I'm like, oh my God. And then I read NPR about what is so important in the North Carolina elections today on Super Tuesday, which is the day that we actually taped this show. All right, I'll get down off my high horse. I'm just so upset, but I just want people to know Emily's List stands for Early Money is Like Yeast. It's supposedly one of the biggest funding sources for women by democratically pro-choice women. And then you find out that there's more rot there than there's benefit. All right, joining me right now is Marsha Brown. Marsha Brown writes for Politico.com. She is their food and agricultural reporter covering federal agencies in the business of food. I've been doing a lot of work on the whole food issue, so I'm so grateful to you, Marsha, for doing this. And we're gonna start with your article at Politico about what is happening this summer. And what we know is that if you go to school during the academic year, a lot of children qualify for either free or reduced lunches, and in some cases, even free or reduced breakfasts. So what that means is at least during the school year for 5 days a week, they're not hungry. And that's a good thing for the kids. It's a good thing for the family, and it actually benefits families, not just kids. Well, then, of course, what happens is that we have a school year that has more in common with raising corn than raising kids, because then we give the kids the summer off, like somehow they're not hungry, all right? And that they don't need breakfast and lunch, or they at least don't need lunch. And so during the pandemic, we were able to recognize that there might be an issue here and that we should continue to feed children, not just during the academic year, but during the summer. And then, of course, we then began to realize that, wait a minute, once the pandemic was over, kids were still hungry. So the federal government has done something. So, Marcia, tell us what the federal government has done, but why it still requires some buy-in from states. And there are certain states that have absolutely agreed to doing this. They want to feed their kids. But no surprising, there's a number of Republicanly controlled states that have decided they don't want to participate in this program. So give us a little bit more of the history of the program, what the federal government is offering to do, and what is the tiny, little, heavy lift that we're asking of states in order to feed their children. And yet there are about 13 states, 12 or 13, that don't want to participate. So I want to welcome you to the program. And I want you to enlighten my audience that the pro-life, pro-human party of the Republican Party wants kids to starve. That's basically how I see it. Anyway, thank you so much for doing this, Marcia. And give us a little bit of a history on your piece that's entitled GOP Govs in 13 States Have Declined to Participate in Summer EBT, the first major permanent expansion of federal hunger programs in decades, So it's important to enlighten my audience. Thank you so much for doing this.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Arnie. I thought this was just a really interesting program because we've talked a lot about, are there any kind of pandemic era programs that are going to carry over and be permanent? And we've seen, you know, a lot of lawmakers talk about, well, that was a special occasion, that was an emergency, and you know, we don't need to continue that. And I think what's different about this program is that actually the Department of Agriculture, which runs this program, was testing pilot versions of this program as early as 2011. So wow. They knew for a long time that there's this summer hunger gap that they weren't meeting. So the federal government was already offering some summer feeding programs, but kids had to get to like a feeding site, a congregate site. And of course, during the pandemic, people didn't want to meet together. So that was when the government was like, well, maybe we can roll out this summer electronic benefits transfer, which is what this program is, where they send $40 per eligible child per month in the summer to help families feed their children. And this kind of works in conjunction with existing summer federal summer feeding programs like the congregate sites that I was describing. So this was called Pandemic EBT. So this rolled out during the Trump administration, and states opted in. The government paid for all of the feeding costs and all of the administrative costs, the federal government, I mean. And it was really popular. And states had to, they also had to opt in. And then as we have kind of left that sort of emergency space, we've seen a lot of, especially Republican lawmakers, kind of saying, well, we don't need to keep treating this like an emergency. We need to get things back to normal. And so lawmakers in Congress actually decided to make this program permanent because they knew that this summer hunger gap existed way before the pandemic, right. And they had to fix that, or they wanted to fix that. And so it was bipartisan. But the new permanent program requires states to pay half of the administrative costs. So the federal government is still, you know, hefting the burden of all of the feeding costs, which is definitely the lion's share of the, you know, expense of this program. But states have to cough up this half of the administrative costs. And there are some technical challenges with that in terms of like they rolled this out really quickly and, you know, state legislatures don't meet as frequently as Congress does. So that's a little bit complicated. But for the most part, it's just a logistical challenge. But governors had to opt into this. And so in December, when the deadline was, coming soon, I started looking into this and I saw we did a story then and I saw that there were a lot of states that hadn't yet signed up. And you know, Christmas was around the corner, so it was people were not going to be working. And the deadline was January 1st. And then we got to that deadline, and what we saw was that virtually every state that at that time decided not to participate was led by a Republican governor.
I'm shocked. Oh, no. Keep going.
So, it was really this. I think when I've been talking to a lot of anti-hunger advocates, they've been talking a lot about how this is maybe reflective of a larger shift. We're seeing for the first time, really, there was a lot of resistance to fully funding WIC, which is a program for low-income moms and babies. It helps with breastfeeding and other really important nutrition issues during pregnancy and postpartum. And in the latest appropriations deal, lawmakers have agreed to fully fund WIC. But that was up in the air for months. That was kind of dicey. And so I think we've seen some of the same rhetoric with some of with this summer EBT program. So what governors have said, Republican governors have said, is that they want to see more nutrition guidance with this program. So where, you know, they want to have limitations on like what kids can buy. They don't want kids to just be able to buy like Fritos and Pepsi products, for example. They want to, you know, focus kids more on vegetables during the obesity crisis, which is what kind of their answer. And then, like I said earlier, there were some governors that were saying that they just don't want this expansion of benefits, basically.
Welfare, welfare. Yeah, they don't like welfare. That I believe that
That
was what the governor
was a quote.
Nebraska
Yeah,
said.
so
That
Nebraska's
was a quote, but he changed his mind. He changed his mind at
he
least for
did.
a year, we know. So I have a couple of questions. So the feds are doing all that, for the most part, the heavy lift. So they're providing the cash and they're providing half the administrative costs. What are we talking about in the way of administrative costs? Because we're talking about an EBT program. We're not talking about setting up these special places where people need to come and then you have to get the food and then we're talking about just basically tweaking something on an EBT card. So when you're talking about half the administrative costs, have you looked at, for example, you mentioned there are 13 states run by Republicans and they're bitching and moaning about the extra costs and the legislature is already gone or they don't have it in their budget. What are we really talking about? Are we talking about millions? Are we talking about half a mil? I'm just trying to figure out what is the half the administrative cost, numero uno. That's my first question. Here's my second question. If they were doing everything anyway, including covering the $40, including covering half the administrative cost, why didn't they just do the whole cigar? Why did they have to like tell states you have to pay for half the administrative costs? Was that the Republicans' way of giving cover to Republican governors so they could opt out because they didn't want to spend the money? I mean, I just feel like it's kind of like you get all the way up to what should be a waterfall, but you miss the top of the mountain by a quarter of an inch, and therefore you don't have a waterfall. You know, it's like so stupid. So what I'm trying to figure out is what are we talking about in the way of money? And why did they make that decision to even require states to have to do anything? Because we're probably not talking about a bucket load of cash anyway.
Yeah, so I think every state is obviously going to be different. You know,
Of
California
course, of
is
course. I'm
way
not just
bigger
surprised.
than some of the other ones, but I would say roughly, I mean, I talked to a lawmaker, a state lawmaker in Louisiana, who is one, which is another state that's not participating. And he told me that the state was turning down roughly $71 million in federal money.
Excuse me.
And I think the number in terms of like the administrative costs is, you know, a few million. So it's significantly less than what the federal government is actually going to spend in terms of funding the program.
Oh, well. And are they doing anything? So, you know, I mean, we have the State of the Union coming up this week. Okay. So this show is going to air on Wednesday. The State of the Union, I believe, is the next night. So as I'm thinking about this, this is another example. Like you just said, Louisiana is going to be leaving $71 million on the table. Now that's a lot of money, but you know what that is? That's a lot of hungry kids. That's a lot of hungry kids. And I think here is another example of what Democrats can do, or frankly, people who give a crap can do, is go into all those 13 states, not only talk about the millions that are being left on the table, because let's remember, you know who should be really ticked off about this, Marsha? All the grocery stores. All the grocery stores, everyone. That is $71 million that's going to Walmart, big grocery chain. That's going to all. I mean, where are the grocery stores on this bill? Because this isn't just feeding Louisiana kids or the other 12 states that have said no. This is actually putting money into the food chain, which pays for the food and the groceries. So the entire state benefits. It's not just about kids not going hungry. It's about more people buying peanut butter. It's about more people buying eggs. It's like so stupid. And to me, it's such an obvious sell. And it wins on so many levels. Who can say no except for one jerk who happens to be a politician? Otherwise, everybody else benefits in the entire state, not just the hungry kids. So as you're looking at this and looking at the states, I'm just trying to figure out this isn't just a hunger advocate story. This is a state advocate story because the money is infused everywhere, not just into those families. And why is no one selling that story?
So there's absolutely support, I would say, in the food and kind of agriculture industry for, the SNAP program in general. And this obviously is kind of a summer boost to the SNAP program. So I think a lot of these groups feel similarly. And, I will say, just to kind of answering one of your previous questions, this was a bipartisan deal when they made the permanent version of this program, and that was the change. This administrative cost. And Senator Bozeman from Arkansas, who's the ranking member on the Senate Ag Committee, he's been very supportive of this program. A lot of lawmakers and the Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack, they've written personal letters to all these governors, kind of beseeching them to join this program. So there has been a real push and outreach on the part of, federal lawmakers. And I do think the industry has been supportive of this, the food industry, for kind of the reasons that you laid out. But I think there are, there's these questions about kind of the nutritional standards. That's been a
But that's true all the
perennial
time. But that's
debate.
true. But that's but that's been true of everything on the EBT is questionable. What are they spending their money on? This is unbelievable to me, Marcia. Back in 2000, I was doing morning drive time radio in Minneapolis and St. Paul. And I had the governor of the time, who was a Republican governor, on with me. And he was bitching and moaning exactly about, how people are spending. And why I said to him, so he was talking about all these programs and we don't know how they're spending their money. So I picked up a school breakfast program that was funded by the state. Okay. So this is something the state had clear oversight of. Sugar pops, Pop Tarts. And I said to the governor, wait a minute, honey bun. This is your program with your money from Minnesota. And you have absolute control of what is put into that program. So walk me through the Pop-Tart piece, okay? Just let me know. I said, aren't you being a bit of a hypocrite? You're bitching and moaning about this because the feds are doing it. And then when you own it, talk about empty calories, honey. You're doing it. This is on a huge, huge radio station in the Twin Cities. And my producer's going, you're going to be in big trouble, Arnie. And I'm like, I don't give a crap. I mean, this is the hypocrisy, is that when they actually control it, Marsha, you don't see this investment in beets and chard and sweet potatoes. You see investment in cheap food. And so for them to suddenly raise questions about the nutrition value when they have control over nutrition, they seem to walk away. So what I'm trying to figure out is, how do we sell this and do an end run around these governors? Because this is such a win-win. And most of those 13 states, if they're probably Republicanly controlled, I suspect most of them are pretty poor as well.
So I do suspect that there are some states, because there are some states that have said they can't get their act together to do it this year, but that they want to participate in 2025. So I think we will see that. I also think that, because this program was running during the pandemic, for some states that were partaking in that pandemic era version of this program, this will be the first summer where families that maybe have relied on that won't have that. And I think that may politically pinch some governors as they are starting to hear from, advocates. I mean, the kind of Nebraska story that we wrote about, this was the governor who said, I don't believe in welfare. That's why he didn't want to participate in the program. He reversed course after he spoke with, young people who had recently graduated high school and talked about like how important this program was. And what's interesting is that he actually implemented, I think, what he's calling like the Nebraska way or something, where there's going to be like more data and more checkpoints on the program. And when I talk to local advocates on the ground, they actually seem to think that those kind of data points will be helpful for the program. And it also gives the governor, this chance to say like, oh, well, he's getting this data and he's gathering evidence about like how the program works and how to make it better and that sort of thing, which I thought was a really interesting kind of layer to that Nebraska piece. So, I mean, a lot of states in at this point, it would be really hard, I think, for states to join for summer 2024, but a lot of advocates at the state level have hoped that Nebraska would be kind of this impetus for their governors to kind of change their mind and also feel
Because
like they're
they
standing
did
out on their
extend the
own.
de my understanding, they did extend the deadline. So the deadline initially was January 1st. They've extended the deadline. Have they put a drop dead date for the deadline, or is the drop dead date whenever you apply? I'm trying
Yeah, they have not put a drop dead date. There was a January 1 deadline to say you were
to
going to apply, and then you had to submit a states had to submit a plan of action basically by I think mid-February. And I asked because this was like right after Nebraska changed their course. And I asked USDA, I said, well, are you guys going to work with states after the deadline? And they basically told me that they don't want a deadline, an arbitrary deadline, to be a reason kids don't get fed in the summer. But it is logistically at this point hard to come up with a plan to implement the program for summer 2024. So they did caution that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, like not participating in 2024 doesn't mean that states can't join in 2025. So
because this is a permanent program, everyone. This is a permanent program. Let me repeat that. This is a permanent program. Thank God. Yeah. Thank God. Thank God. All right. Before I let you go, you mentioned a story about the state of New York. And I want people to hear this story because I've been banging this drum forever. Because in the end, you want programs to get to people who need to access them. You don't want people to have to jump through hoops in order to prove they're so poor that they should still be able to access them. And in the end, it's a win-win. The people that need the program benefit from the program. The state and the city actually save money because they're not asking people to jump through hoops. So really quickly, Marcia, give my audience a little window in on what the state of New York is doing, because if nothing else, it proves everything I've ever believed in.
Sure. So, I would say that the larger backdrop is that there are several states that are kind of behind on their SNAP applications in terms of the administration. So folks are applying, but the government is not like working through their applications and getting them connected to this food assistance. And so that's the backdrop. I mean, Tennessee is one of them. And, you know, New York also had a SNAP backlog. And so what I read recently is that the city got a waiver from the governor to essentially make it easier for folks to apply for the program and then stay in the program. They could now, you know, apply by phone, so they don't have to do an in-person kind of interview. And then typically SNAP participants, after 6 months of participation, they have another letter basically saying that everything has changed, or nothing has changed in terms of their kind of financial situation, meaning that they're still eligible. And so the governor said that, you know, New York City doesn't have to have that letter anymore. And basically the city was able to process, you know, hundreds of thousands more applications and, eliminate a lot of that backlog. And they attribute that to these administrative changes, which allow essentially the government to sort of assess if someone is eligible and not have to kind of keep reassessing it.
So, you know, I would love to sit down with Kathy Hochul. I'm not sure she's my favorite governor. But anyway, I would love to sit down with her and ask her, why are you only giving the waiver to New York City? There's already a rural-urban divide. And if you are the governor of New York, you know that, you know, finding at the 6 month program to be 6 months to be able to requalify, all those things that you were just talking about, if it's a burden for people who are poor in New York, I suspect it's a burden for everyone. All right. And at some point in time, and now we've seen that it really has a significant benefit. More people are able to qualify. It's actually saving the city some money because they don't have to then go through the 6 month program. And again, governors, think about this. Don't aid and abet the rural urban divide. If it's working for people who are struggling, who are hungry, who are poor, then that's true whether you're a town of 1,000 people or you're a city of a couple of million. And so again, I don't quite understand why we make that line of demarcation, because in the end, I am looking over and over again, Marcia, for Velcro to hold us together as a society. That's really what I'm looking at. And when I suddenly realize that we are doing things like, for example, I was mentioning to you that in the state of Vermont, the state of Massachusetts, and the state of Maine, any child that attends public school in those three states can now get a free lunch. That's it. Every kid, whether their parents drive a Maserati or their parents hitchhike to school. Okay. It doesn't matter. So every kid, so therefore there's no stigma attached. There's no burden attached. And everyone knows that they actually get a meal. And I think that that's so important. So as I'm looking at this, I want to follow up on that story that you told me about New York, because I'm sort of curious as to understand why they would even do that kind of divide, because it makes no sense. And again, if you're poor and you're hungry, treat me the same. That's all I have to ask for, is treat me the same. And that would be interesting. And at some point, I would also love to know whether that small amount of administrative costs, for example, in Louisiana, whether there could be a nonprofit that would be willing to sort of step up, pay that bridge, and then in 2025, Louisiana could step up and pay it. Because again, maybe they could say that the legislature's out of session or the budget's already been settled. I get that. I get that. But we're not talking about a huge heavy lift. We're probably talking about a small amount of money. And if you can make that contribution to pay that difference, then the state benefits, poor kids benefit, and ultimately Louisiana gets its cover for the summer so they don't have hungry kids. Thank you so much for doing this, Marsha Brown. You always find interesting stories about food. And food is about justice. Food is about justice. So thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Arnie.
You're welcome. Marsha Brown, food and agriculture reporter at Politico, covering federal agencies and the business of food. Her piece is about GOP governors in 13 states have declined to participate in the summer EBT program, the first major permanent expansion of the federal hunger program in decades. This, everyone, is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Stick around, folks. We will be right back.
AIDS activist Hydea Broadbent had no choice but to be brave. I'm Bill Newman. This is the Civil Liberties Minute, and that's how The Week magazine began its recent story about Hydea Broadbent. Hydea Broadbent's biological mother had been addicted to drugs, and she had been put up for adoption. Then, at age 3, Hydea was diagnosed with HIV, and she wasn't expected to live past age 5. Hydea Broadbent's HIV developed into AIDS, and the stigma around AIDS at that time was so great that if she sneezed, her kindergarten teacher sprayed her with Clorox. Hydea Broadbent was a vivacious child, and she began speaking publicly about AIDS when she was 6. She appeared on Nickelodeon, a special with basketball superstar Magic Johnson, just after Magic revealed that he was HIV positive, and on Oprah and Good Morning America. And at age 11 in 1996, she addressed the Republican National Convention where she said, "I am the next Maya Angelou. I may even be the first woman president. I am the future, and I have AIDS." As Magic Johnson said, Hydea changed the world with her bravery. Thanks to her, millions were educated, stigmas were broken, and attitudes about HIV/AIDS changed. We are indebted to Hydea Broadbent for her courage and activism and mourn her passing in February at age 39. The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the ACLU because freedom can't protect itself.
This is Lincoln Mitchell with today's Mitchell Minute. Presidential primaries are always strange, particularly in cycles like this when there are essentially two incumbents running, and we've known at least 3 months before the first votes were cast who the nominees would be. Nonetheless, yesterday was Super Tuesday, and Trump won every state but one, and Biden won every state. That was pretty much expected. I suppose Haley's victory in Vermont is a little bit of a surprise. And for the next days and weeks, people are going to try to figure out what the meaning of this is, what we can determine from this. And the truth is, these primaries mean nothing. The only thing the primaries matter for is selecting the nominee. Probing too much after that, did it matter that Trump only got this percent, that Biden only got that percent, that the second place candidate said this? None of that really matters. There's no real evidence to suggest that that's true. But the punditry and the media want to talk about that because they want to talk about something. They're so obsessed with finding a story in the bizarre, irrelevant tea leaves that are primary results. The real story remains. This is an election between an essentially aging but reasonably competent and effective president who is on the center left and certainly has his flaws, against somebody who would destroy American democracy and possibly the American state as well. And what percent Nikki Haley got in Virginia, or how many people voted uncommitted in California, well, in Colorado, that doesn't matter.
The Mitchell Minute is a daily minute or so of political analysis from me, Professor Lincoln Mitchell. If you want to hear more of my opinion and analysis, you can subscribe to my YouTube channel at Mitchell Minute or subscribe to my Substack, Kibitzing with Lincoln.
When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when your eyes are open, when you know the history, when your parents lived through things that looked so much like this, all the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place, and you once again see the rising of the master race. When you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance, when you know for many people this will be their last chance, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you.
it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth. When you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth, when they're opening the camps not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before. When Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news. When the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity, when you know where the kids are kept locked inside their cells, when you see approaching the future this foretells, when they're coming for your neighbors, when they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away, when you know where they keep the buses, you've been to the parking lot, perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933.
Cowboys ain't easy to love and they're harder to hold. They'd rather give you a song than diamonds or gold.
Lone Star belt buckles and old faded Levi's, and each night begins a new day. If you don't understand him, he don't die young. He'll probably just ride away.
Mamas, don't let your babies grow up to be cowboys. Don't let them pick guitars or drive them old trucks. Let them doctors and lawyers and such. Mamas, don't let your babies grow up to be cowboys, 'cause they never stay home and they're always alone, even with someone they love.
Cowboys like smoky old pool rooms and clear mountain mornings,
little warm puppies and children and girls of the night. Them that don't know him won't like him, and them that do sometimes won't know how to take him.
He ain't wrong, he's just different, but his pride won't let him do things to make you think he's right.
Mama, don't let your babies grow up to be cowboys.
Welcome back to part two of the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We continue to record on Tuesday morning. So we have hung out with Charlie Russo before. He is the Joseph Panzer Chair in Education in the School of Education and Health Sciences, the director of its PhD program and research professor of law in the School of Law at the University of Dayton. He also was the 1998-1999 president of the Education Law Association. He speaks extensively on issues in education law around the globe. So I want to welcome Charles back to the program. And Charlie, I know that you were just recently in Louisiana, I believe it was, and that you gave a paper that actually sort of addresses some of these issues that we're going to be talking about right now. And the title of your paper was Faith-Based Charter Schools and the Establishment Clause. Like the pig with wings, they look good on paper, but can or should they get off the ground? Let me welcome you back to the program, Charlie. And I know we're not in Louisiana. We're just on a little station in Concord, New Hampshire that's heard around the country. But let's talk about what is the driver for this.
Thanks for having me back. It's always good to visit with you.
Oh, it's great. We know that Oklahoma is basically the state where this is being tested. The concept of, you know, a charter school, but a religious charter school, not just a charter school that's run by a religious entity, but a charter school that is both run by a religious entity, but that also then proselytizes during the course of what you are learning in that charter school. And that, I think, is a great divide. You know, it's not that the Baptists or the Catholics or the madrasas are running it. It's what they're ultimately teaching that I think becomes a problem. So let's talk a little bit about this sort of Oklahoma push to make this happen and your concerns about the fact that there is this concept of the separation of church and state. There is this idea that these are public dollars that are not to be used to proselytize a specific religious entity, but yet these religious charter schools would do exactly that.
Agreed. I mean, let me begin by saying, for people who work in the area of religion or church and state, there are two types: accommodationist and separationist. I'm much more an accommodationist on aid. I think more aid should be available. However, a big but, that being said, I think this really is a bridge too far for the reasons you just laid out. In the full paper that I just sent you, that's 14,000 words with over 200 footnotes. It's for lawyers, not for educators, in a sense. I raised some of the concerns that you just mentioned. Number one, it's going to be using public money to teach religion, not teach about religion.
Right.
There are also questions over governance. Who's going to say what's going to happen? What's going to happen with kids who are not of the Catholic faith? Will they be admitted? Will they not be admitted? I think with some tinkering, it might be able to survive, but I don't think it's going to survive now. On April 2nd, the Supreme Court of Oklahoma, as you may have read, is going to have oral arguments or conduct oral arguments. Lord only knows when they're going to get that back out. The school hopes to open this fall, so hopefully they'll turn it around reasonably quickly with a decision. And again, as somebody who supports aid under child benefit that goes directly to the child, here it's really kind of going to the institution. Kids will be beneficiaries, but I just think it stands a child benefit test on its ear.
I've always been a little bit nervous about charter schools. And believe it or not, I don't believe in charter schools. I believe in charter education. I'd love to start all over, okay? And not for like a particular school, because if you need to improve a school, you probably need to improve a school, okay? And you shouldn't be able to separate out through this concept of charter. But I've almost thought that charter schools were the bridge to vouchers. And that ultimately what the goal was to resegregate public schools and therefore to get rid of public education. And then vouchers will then put dollars into the hands of parents. And then they could decide with those dollars, those public dollars, where they wanted to, you know, send their kids. And in my state, for example, the state of New Hampshire, we're able to use what they call educational freedom accounts to go to a private school, to go to a religious school, or to even homeschool. Okay. So we can, I mean, with the sky's the limit. The limit, however, is financial, so that you can't be more than, I don't know, X number percent of the poverty level. There's no requirement as to where you use this money. The problem with charter schools is that they're still supposedly under the public school umbrella with the concept of public education. And now we're talking about public dollars directly going not to parents, but to, as you point out, this religious institution that is going to be in charge of hiring, in charge of firing, in charge of setting the curriculum, in charge of establishing basically what the teachers basically need to have in order to teach in that school. And the curriculum then can include, you know, maybe Genesis and talk about the creation theory, not as a book in the Bible, but basically as, you know, science. So I guess I'm nervous about this, but do we really need charter schools anymore if we've got vouchers? Why don't we just take out the whole sort of phoniness of charter schools and just say, okay, you want those dollars? You pick where you want those dollars to go.
You raised some good points. And in my paper, the one I just sent you, I probably should have sent it yesterday, I raised exactly that question about creation versus Genesis and so on, right, and evolution. But let me just back up a little bit. The charter school movement in the United States began in 1991 in Minnesota. I'm not really good about remembering dates, but I think it was 1990. I was invited to speak at the Canadian Education Law Conference in Edmonton. Mm-hmm. And charter schools actually moved south from Canada to the United States. And they are, in fact, parallel, and their foundation is largely modeled at the Roman Catholic education, the idea being to streamline bureaucracy. The principle of subsidiarity, bring decision-making to the level where it's going to be made. And they are, in a sense, kind of a generation two or 2.0 of the old magnet schools. They're put together generally now publicly. Baltimore back in the 90s had a company, Educational Alternatives Institute, I think it's Initiatives, Educational Alternative Initiatives. And they ran most of the public schools in Baltimore, but that failed. And so now they're all public school, public charters.
Mm-hmm.
I'm agnostic about charters. I think that some are good, some are not so good. The thing I like about them is they do give parents a choice, particularly in not just in inner cities, but other locations where public education is not doing well. That being said.
But are you making an assumption that charter schools are doing well?
I said,
see, the thing is, I mean, as soon as you say charter, everyone says, oh, it must be better. But we're finding out more and more when you actually start evaluating results out of charter schools, that better it may be more fiction than reality.
And perhaps in some places, but bear in mind, you know, one of the things for parents, and I do support parental choice, I don't particularly support vouchers, but charter schools, if they don't meet their goals, they can be shut down.
Okay.
They get a 3 to 5 year contract and will be shut down. How do you close down poor underperforming public schools? And that being said, although I'm a product of Catholic education, I'm a great supporter of public education, particularly in Brooklyn, where we came from,
yeah,
was a great equalizer.
Well, so here's my question. Isn't charter schools a punt? Isn't vouchers a punt? What you're saying is that by definition, we can't fix public education. And because we can't fix public education, therefore, we're going to figure out what is a backdoor out of public education. What's wrong with public education? Maybe what's wrong is funding. Maybe what's wrong is the size of the classroom. Maybe what's wrong is that kids come in hungry. Maybe what's wrong is that there's not enough aides in the classroom. Maybe what's wrong is they have old textbooks. We know what the challenges are to public education, but by creating a voucher, by creating a charter, what you're basically saying is you're washing your hands like Pontius Pilate, I'll use all those religious references, and you're saying, I don't want to spend the time or energy fixing public schools, therefore, I'm going to give you, like, you know, the road out, and somehow that road out is my answer to fixing public schools. That to me is that's dishonest, because it doesn't really fix it, and it also means I've begin to question, do you then really care? What's the accountability in a voucher program? What's the real accountability in a charter school? And you say all these charter schools after 3 or 5 years could be shut down. So I'm going to challenge you, Charlie. How many have been?
I don't have the statistics at my fingertips, but there is certainly every year there's litigation when charter schools are shut down.
Okay.
And the closures are upheld.
Yep. Yep.
So, I mean, and you know, you raised the mention of vouchers. In 2002, a Supreme Court case out of Cleveland, Zelman versus Simmons-Harris, essentially allowed vouchers for parents in inner city schools. Again, I'm not a real big fan of vouchers, but in that case, Cleveland was a failing school system taken over by the state.
Yep.
And it was still operating under a school desegregation order.
Okay.
So Ohio adopted a law which said parents in Cleveland, if their kids are in failing schools, have the option of enrolling their children or children of color. Not one public school, not one suburb, accepted one child from the inner city.
Oh, my God.
To me, that's racism.
Yeah.
So parents had the option. And when I talk about this in class, I ask my students, put yourself in the position of those parents in Cleveland. You're in a public school system that has failed for a lot of reasons. And again, I support public education greatly. Do you leave your child in a school that you know is failing, or do you take the option of putting the child in a school where there's a chance the child will succeed? I don't want to throw public education overboard, but next year, and maybe we can talk about this again next year or sooner, is the 100th anniversary of Pierce versus Society of Sisters, in case you may know, where the court, number one, upheld the right of faith-based schools to operate. But number two, the great line you're probably familiar with, the child is not the mere creature of the state. Those who control have the right to control his destiny and direct his education. I'm paraphrasing, chewing on my words a little bit. So parental choice has been around for 100 years.
We keep using the concept of parental choice. And then you find out that these private schools, that these religious schools, that maybe even these charter schools, it turns out it's not parental choice, it's the school choice. What did you just tell me? You just told me the story about all these kids in a failing school that wanted to go into these more predominantly white schools that were better schools in the suburbs. But guess what? Who said no? It was the school. Right. So whose choice was it? It's never been the parents' choice. There's always been a gatekeeper, and the gatekeeper isn't the parents, it is the school. If the school wants to say yes, except in a public school, which has to say yes to every child, they can't say no. It is by definition public. But as soon as you take that word public out, you have drained the concept of choice out. You just quoted me that case about the fact that these children are not, they're not created by the state, they're created by the parents. But in the end, you keep suggesting that it's parental choice, and I'm telling you that's horse crap. It's not, it's school choice. And yet we keep, you know, supporting kids, suggesting that this is their choice, and it's not, Charlie. It's not. Oh my God. It just makes me so upset because I keep seeing kids, like you just described, not being able to get into those schools.
But go back to Zelman. What would you do if your parents in Cleveland, are you going to leave them in a school system that's going to take time to repair? And again, I'm agnostic on charters. I'm not a great big supporter of them. I'm agnostic on vouchers. I'm thinking about the parent. What can or should parents do? They don't have the luxury of waiting 8 or 10 years till the school system's repaired. They want their kid educated now. The exact quote, by the way, from Pierce, the child is not the mere creature of the state. Those who nurture him and direct his destiny have the right, coupled with a high duty, to recognize and prepare him for additional obligations. My apologies for the male pronouns without being inclusive, but it's a 1925 Supreme Court decision. That's how it was written, and I keep the court's language.
Now, you mentioned that the Supreme Court is going to be looking at the Oklahoma case.
Of Oklahoma in April.
And I want to remind everyone that the Supreme Court, you know, historically only takes about 80 cases a year. This Supreme Court has been very interesting because they actually go case hunting. They don't take a case. They make a decision that they want to sort of weigh in on something, and then they grab that case. And what's so interesting to me is that they grabbed Oklahoma, because Oklahoma will really be testing this fundamentalist Christian MAGA conservative reactionary court that, you know, used to be called the Supremes, but I don't think that they're Supreme anymore. And I am curious, how do you think this court is going to weigh in on this, given their deference to, I think, all things religious, as opposed to the concept of public? So, I mean, I'm very nervous about the separation of church and state. I don't know whether Oklahoma will actually lose with this court, because this court has been moving so close to the edge when it comes to using public dollars in any way, shape, or form, especially when it comes to sort of investing in things that actually seem to be religious and not public.
Fair enough. Just to clarify, April 2nd will be oral arguments at the Supreme Court of Oklahoma.
However,
in the manuscript that I just sent you now, I raised the question whether the Supreme Court would take up a case like this.
Oh, absolutely.
They have the option of saying no because it's a state-level issue. However, given the decisions in the last 6 or 7 years, the court has become much more accommodationist friendly. And I think that they might take up a case like this. And if they did, I do think they would probably uphold the voucher program based on their 3 most recent decisions. Oh. But as we say, the check's in the mail.
Yeah. What about the Oklahoma Supreme Court? Aren't they going to rubber stamp whatever basically the legislature and those public dollars are going to go to? I mean, well, Oklahoma just feels like it feels like a neon red swamp that there is no place where they would actually kind of look at the, you know, the original concept. Like, I don't know what this is going to be based on, the Oklahoma Constitution.
I've only been to Oklahoma once, so I can't speak about the people. But among the people opposing the faith-based charter schools is the state's attorney general, and is doing it on grounds under the state constitution and a variety of state statutes. Again, I think many of the claims are with merit. I don't want to go on a tangent, but the one I think that is not meritorious, or less meritorious, is about what might happen to kids in special needs, because the federal IDEA already limits the amount of money that can be spent in faith-based schools by regulation. So that's one I don't think they could question them for. But I think the other issues, such as curriculum hiring and firing, those are all legitimate issues. I don't know enough, frankly, about the Oklahoma Supreme Court, but my instinct is kind of in agreement with you that they would probably uphold it. But again, it depends how strictly they interpret their own statutes.
So I guess here's my question about Oklahoma. So when Oklahoma is now, you know, moving in the direction of religious charter schools, were there any qualifications on what they were assuming would be happening in these religious charter schools? Did they put any parameters, or was it basically, here's the check? It's a public institution, but it's a religious charter institution. I mean, I hear what you're saying with the Attorney General, but is the Attorney General challenging the law that opened this possibility? Were there any limits put into this law? Or basically, did they just basically say, here's the check, I don't care what religious institution is running it, you get to make all the determinations about how this school is run?
Okay, they're challenging the statewide charter school board, okay, not the statute, but he is raising the issues that you just said, because from what I can find, there's not sufficient controls in there to safeguard for these things. And that's a concern that I share. And for what it's worth, within a matter of weeks, Guam, which is a long distance from here, obviously, also approved the faith-based charter bill. Wow. And they overrode the veto of their governor. When I spoke in Louisiana, the conference was about Louisiana's constitution, but I tried to make the hook, which satisfied them, was that if it passes in Oklahoma, a state like Louisiana with a pretty significant Catholic population might be the next to follow, and then the dominoes, if you will, may fall, that this will grow. I don't know whether the Supremes will take this case, but if it spreads to other states, they're going to have to take a case of this nature within the next couple of years.
So we've been following stuff going on in Texas. And I've mentioned this before, and I'll mention it again. And one of the things that Texas is now doing is that they're looking to bring chaplains in as opposed to guidance counselors into public schools, so that you could provide a chaplain from a religious institution to provide the kind of support children may need in a school. And I think it may be voluntary. I'm not sure that these chaplains will be paid by the school, but the door is being opened to these chaplains. And one of the stories that I read vis-a-vis Texas is that there's a Satanic temple. And the Satanic temple is so excited about this because they're thinking, oh my God, we got chaplains coming up the wazoo. We would love to send our Satanic temple chaplains in. So again, here's my question to you, is that what is going to be the definition of religious institution? Are they going to be white Christian nationalists and they're going to define religion only in one purview? Or could my Satanic temple apply to create a charter school? And therefore, hey, you know, it's like the sky's the limit here, gang. And once you open the floodgates, you know, how do you then dissect? It's kind of like what's happening right now with IVF. There's a baby begins at conception. Well, wait a minute. You just froze a baby with the IVF. Well, that's different. No, it's not different, you know? And it's like I think that they keep trying to figure out, how do I do this? But every time they open the door, they suddenly realize they don't really want to open a door. They just want their door open, not the door open.
I can't recall whether you and I spoke about this, because I did another radio interview, but I did write an article on the chaplains in the conversation about Texas move towards faith-based chaplains. And I've written another article, and I've got another article I need to finish on Satan clubs. I did an op-ed in the Dayton Daily News about it.
Yeah.
And my point is, I think in line with yours, there's a federal bill called the Equal Access Act from 1984. It was designed to bring Christian prayer and Bible study clubs in school.
Right.
And Jerry Falwell must be spinning in his grave. He was one of the supporters of it, because rightfully so, LGBT plus clubs and what have you have been allowed to meet under those purposes. And so far, in one case from Pennsylvania, a Satan club had the right to meet there too. So it seems to me, if you open it up to religion, what the creators of the bill in Texas didn't anticipate What about the Satan clubs? What about the Muslims? I mean, look, Doe v. Santa Fe, an early 2000 case from Texas about prayer at football games, went by Doe because the two people challenging the prayers were a Roman Catholic family and a family of members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Right.
They were being harassed at home because they opposed prayer from a different denomination other than their own. And I'm a bit naive. I like to think religion should bring people together rather than keep us apart. So I think you're on the mark. If you open the door to one, you're going to have to open it to everybody.
Well, and again, so just think about this. The whole sad story about what's going on with vouchers and to some extent even with charter schools is that, you know, this idea of the public sphere is that, you know, those public dollars are supposed to be able to invite everyone in. The idea of vouchers is basically not to invite people in. It's to separate us again. It's to resegregate everything that we had worked to, like, sort of change and create this concept. But of course, you also know, Charlie, that there's this now, this the original war was on CRT, critical race theory. What's the new war? It's on diversity and inclusion. I mean, that's the new war. I mean, pretty soon it's going to be on anything that's called public. You know, it can be dollars, just not, I mean, it can be public dollars, but not for a public purpose. And I think that's really what the goal is. I'm going to send you a check, but then I'm going to decide what to do with the check. And I'm thinking, well, is that going to be a good thing for the country? And what is that going to create in the way of, if there's separation now, it just goes even more and more aggressively separate, because we've done nothing to find out what is that common sphere. And that's always been that's why I believe in universal service, Charlie. I believed in universal service since I was 17 years old. I think we either all go to war or none of us go to war. We all serve or none of us serve. And frankly, you know where my model is? My model is the Mormon Church. Because the Mormon Church says to its followers that they have to give 2 years to the Church of Latter-day Saints, that they have to do something, proselytize, sing in the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, but they have to give back. Well, you know, based on that Mormon principle, I think that should be an American principle. And yet all these things that we're talking about is not about bringing us together, but about finding ways to use public dollars to actually separate us. And that's what so terrifies me.
There are some people in that movement, no doubt, have that. But there's also a number of people who are of good faith, just want better options for their kids. I try to find the good in things, but it certainly presents a challenge to what's going on. But the bigger question is, if we want public education to survive, which it has to, how are we going to improve it? How are we going to work around to resolve? And one of the difficulties, I've raised this in class, public schools take anybody who shows up. You know, one of the Bushes, all children shall come to school ready to learn. Well, if they come in hungry or abused or tired, they're not going to learn. So you need to give them breakfast and lunch and what have you. Right. People criticize that. But then you get issues. I support tenure. But how do you terminate teachers who aren't doing the job?
Right.
How do you make schools run better? So it's a much larger question.
Well, and then you also start asking, you know, like what is it? I think it's Finland. In Finland, the highest paid people in the country are teachers. So you know what? Quality goes where the money is. So if you're going to make a lot of money as a banker and you're real smart, you'll go to banking. But if you're going to make decent and a lot of money and you're going to go into education, you're going to go into education. So in a lot of ways, we've sort of, you know, we've set ourselves up to fail. And that is part of the problem. It's not that we have bad teachers. It's like you're asking people to sacrifice to educate your kids. But if our kids are our vital resource, they shouldn't be asked to sacrifice.
When we get off the air, I'm going to send you a cartoon. I keep a cartoon database for presentations.
Yeah.
It's a man sitting in a chair. You're going to do what? No child of mine is going to do that.
Yeah,
no child of mine is ever going to be a teacher.
Exactly.
Be a football player, a banker, go where the money is.
All right. Charlie Russo is the Joseph Panzer Chair in Education, the School of Education and Law at the University of Dayton. We've been talking about charter schools and religion. This, everyone, is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, our producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We will schmooze tomorrow, everyone. Ciao. You better just